excited to see that so many people are interested in our reading today. And I'm also excited and honored to introduce our guest here, Tivatrudi Omolungu. But before I I'm going to say some words about you and your persona, I will quickly introduce the event today, which is part of the IZ3W event series, 50 Jahre und immer noch bissig. And at this point, I also want to thank IZ3W and the Kommunale Kino for making this possible here today. And my name is Julia Rensing. I'm from Freiburg Postkolonial, and I'm going to moderate our reading and discussion here today. So it's going to be a mixture from reading, but also, we will discuss a lot and have a conversation. But also Wilfried Brock, Ms. Omolungu's husband, joins us today. And just two quick questions before. Is it okay if we report this reading here for everybody? Is it fine? Okay. If not, somebody has to give a sign. And then also, is there somebody who doesn't speak German here?
English.
Yeah, but we might have a part in German. A small part. But only if everybody speaks German. Is that the case? Well, then, let me introduce our guest here, Tivatrudi Omolungu. She's a well-known public figure in Namibia. She's a language teacher by training, introduced French in Namibian schools and in UNAM, the University of Namibia. She helped to build up the Franco-Namibian Cultural Center, FNCC, in Windhoek, and worked at the Namibian National Commission for UNESCO in the Ministry of Education. Today, she's the Namibian ambassador in Senegal, to Senegal, Mali, the Gambia, Guinea, and Guinea-Bissau. And she's also a mother of four, and a wife, and an author. And that's why we are here today. Thank you for being here, Tivatrudi.
I think I must just say a few words, and really humbly thank you so much for showing such an interest in my book, you know, thousands of kilometers away from here, a story coming from Namibia, and you show this big interest. I want to thank you, Julia, for these efforts. You didn't start only now to be interested. You contacted me without knowing who I am. Can I answer this question because you are writing a thesis and so on? This is how it started. And today we are here to talk about my book, and you'll see through my book, or throughout my book, it is about surprises of my life. And this is one of the surprises again. So my surprises are continuing. Thank you so much.
And I would also like to introduce Wilfried Brock here today, who was ready voluntarily to also join our conversation. And because when we talk about your book, we will also have a lot of references to Namibian history. And to get a better understanding of this history, Mr. Brock volunteered to give us a short outline to really sketch this history to allow us all to understand what Ms. Omolungu experienced during her life journey, so to say. And we have the option to do this small part in German. And I think, is that still the case? Does everybody speak German? Those who came?
No.
Okay. No, you don't? Okay. Okay, then the floor is yours.
Okay. Do I stand or do I sit? That's the question.
Either way you feel
either
comfortable.
Way. Yeah. Maybe stand. You're a teacher by profession. Mm-hmm. Please. Teacher stand.
Ich bin sehr lang, also ich sitze lieber gerne. Wenn das geht, kann jeder mich hören. Gut. Also zu meiner Person ist nur noch zu sagen, außer dass ich natürlich Trudis Mann bin. Ich bin Wilfried Brock. Ich bin aus Namibia, dort geboren, dort aufgewachsen, lebe dort. Bin also kein Deutscher, aber meine Eltern sind ursprünglich Deutsch und daher spreche ich auch Deutsch, eigentlich genauso gut wie ihr. Vielleicht fehlt da hier und da so eine moderne Vokabel. Wir sagen zum Beispiel nicht Handy und so. Da haben wir andere Ausdrücke für. Aber ansonsten, nur dass ihr nicht denkt, so, wo kommt der denn her? Das wollte ich einmal nur sagen. Ansonsten ist über mich doch zu sagen, dass ich war damals in den 80er Jahren, damals war der Unabhängigkeitskampf noch am Gange, da wurde ich von der südafrikanischen Apartheidsarmee, die ja Namibia damals besetzt hielt, conscripted, also Militär aufgerufen, eingezogen. Und das war nun nicht meine Sache, dass ich das machen würde. Ich bin damals auch ins Exil gegangen und habe dann nachher in Sambia meine Frau Trudi kennengelernt. Das reicht über mich. Was die Geschichte von Namibia anbetrifft, nur um das, vielleicht der eine oder andere wird sagen, ach, kennen wir alles schon, ich habe schon genügend drüber gelesen, aber vielleicht nicht jeder und manchmal stellt man fest, Leute kommen da mit relativ naiven Fragen und dann realisiert man, die haben eigentlich keine wirkliche Ahnung und daher, um den ganzen Background besser zu verstehen, denke ich, will ich das mal eben nur sehr kurz machen. Also Namibia, im Südwesten von Afrika gelegen, am Atlantischen Ozean, ist ein Land, recht groß, ich weiß nicht, ist das doppelt so groß wie die Bundesrepublik Deutschland, ungefähr. Und dennoch haben wir bis heute nur eine Bevölkerung von 2,4 Millionen Menschen im ganzen Land. Das ist das trockenste Land in Afrika, südlich des Äquators. Und natürlich diese Situation, riesiges Land, sehr wenig Menschen, hat natürlich auch dann was damit zu tun. Als die Kolonisten, die Briten, die Franzosen, die Portugiesen und so und die Deutschen relativ spät erst anfingen, Afrika zu kolonisieren, in dem späten 19. Jahrhundert, war Namibia erstmal überhaupt nicht interessant. Das ist ja nur Wüste, da ist nichts zu holen. Also wurde das erstmal ausgelassen. Aber als es nachher wirklich darum ging, also gab es den Wettlauf um Afrika, wo die verschiedenen Kolonialmächte sich dann wirklich anstrengten, um dann noch so schnell wie möglich, bevor die anderen das wegrapschen, das auch unter sich zu bekommen. Und so kam es damals, dass Namibia deutsche Kolonie wurde. Und so hieß dann Deutsch-Südwestafrika. Aber diese Kolonialzeit war relativ kurz, aber dennoch sehr brutal. Die deutsche Kolonialmacht war nun nicht alle, die war alles andere als liebenswürdig oder so. Namibia war auch eine Siedlerkolonie, das heißt, wegen dem trockenen Klima, also nicht so sehr tropische Krankheiten und so, es war also interessant, da dann zu sagen, gut, Deutsche können dann jetzt hierher kommen und da siedeln. Und Land wurde vergeben und dann wurde natürlich das Land für die Schwarzen so langsam immer enger. Und das dauerte dann auch nicht allzu viele Jahre. Da gab es natürlich dann auch Aufstände und es gab besonders bei dem großen Aufstand von 1904 bis 1908, wo die deutschen Soldaten da sozusagen gründlich aufgeräumt haben. Aber die Deutschen hatten nur nicht allzu lange Zeit, davon zu profitieren, denn dann kam der Erste Weltkrieg und Südafrika, das ist das Nachbarland von Namibia, die kamen dann also auf der britischen Seite in den Krieg rein und besetzten Namibia. Und somit war die deutsche Zeit vorbei und auch nach dem Krieg, im Ersten Weltkrieg, gab es ja die Friedenskonferenz in Versailles und auch eins der ersten Sachen war da, dass die Deutschen unterschreiben mussten, dass sie ihre Kolonien für immer und ewig aufgeben würden. Und so bekam Namibia wurde dann ein Mandatsgebiet unter dem Völkerbund, den es damals gab, wurden dann die verschiedenen ehemaligen deutschen Kolonien und auch Gebiete, die die Türken hatten, wie Palästina und so, die wurden dann als Mandatsgebiete an die Siegermächte des Ersten Weltkriegs vergeben. Und so fiel Namibia dann unter Südafrika. Und Südafrika war ja nun auch eine Siedlerkolonie und daher der ganze die Siedlerkolonie, das ging weiter. Die hatten erstmal einen Teil der deutschen Siedler rausgeschmissen und brachten dann ihre eigenen weißen südafrikanischen Siedler ins Land. Und das ging dann weiter, aber dann in 1948 passierte was in Südafrika, nämlich da gab es einen Regierungswechsel. Eine Partei kam dort an die Macht, die nannte sich die Nationale Partei und das waren burische Nationalisten. Und die kamen dann mit dem Konzept der Apartheid an. Ich meine, Rassismus und Kolonialismus und das war ja vorher schon da. Also Schwarze waren nie gleichberechtigt vorher, aber nun wurde das in einem richtigen Stil von, das wird jetzt alles gesetzlich untermauert und wird also geordnet und sozusagen auf die Art und Weise gemacht, dass die Weißen für immer oben bleiben sollten und die Schwarzen immer unten bleiben sollten. Wohngebiete wurden segregiert und die Schulen waren eigentlich sowieso schon immer getrennt vorher, aber nun gab es auch extra Lehrpläne für die Weißen, die sollten ausgebildet werden, dass sie nachher das Land regieren und die Schwarzen, denen sollte man in der Schule eigentlich nur das basische Lesen und Schreiben beibringen und so viel, wie sie brauchen, damit sie günstige Arbeitskräfte für die weiße Ökonomie sind. Und das natürlich, da gab es dann nachher Sachen wie, also das Schwarze, die wurden dann aus ihren Wohngebieten und rausgeholt und dann hieß es, nee, wir haben euch da ein neues Wohngebiet da hinten, 5 Kilometer außerhalb des Ortes gebaut. Und das passierte zum Beispiel 1959 in Windhoek, als die südafrikanische Macht nun anfing, Leute zu forcibly, also mit Gewalt zwangsumzusiedeln. Das kam dann zu einem Aufstand, da gab es dann Schießereien und am Ende waren natürlich eine ganze Reihe Leute auch tot. Und das hatte natürlich die schwarze namibische Bevölkerung sehr davon überzeugt, dass also hier kommt kein Frieden, das wird hier nur immer schlimmer. Und zur gleichen Zeit wurden ja andere Länder in Afrika, wie Ghana und zum Beispiel, andere unabhängig. Und da merkte auch die namibische Bevölkerung, also hier muss jetzt ein Wandel kommen, irgendwas muss sich hier ändern. Und so kam es dann 1960 dann zur Gründung der SWAPO, der namibischen Unabhängigkeitsbewegung. Aber das erste Ziel für die war, dass sie zur UNO gingen und sagten, UNO, ihr seid ja die Nachkommen des Völkerbundes, ihr müsst uns retten kommen. Und das versuchte man für ein paar Jahre, aber Südafrika hatte sich nicht sonderlich daran gekratzt und zumal die hatten ja auch die Unterstützung von einigen Westmächten wie Amerika, England und so weiter, die ja interessiert daran waren, dass sie die Bodenschätze in Südafrika und auch in Namibia ausbeuten konnten. Also war da auch kein wirklicher Druck auf Südafrika, irgendwas an dem Thema zu machen. Man bemühte sich durch die UNO, Internationaler Gerichtshof und so weiter. Aber dann 1966 war man der Meinung, also so geht es nicht weiter und der bewaffnete Befreiungskrieg begann. Und das ging dann bis 1989, als die Südafrikaner dann endlich einsahen, dass sie den Krieg nicht gewinnen konnten und daher dann realisierten, dass sie sich vielleicht zurückziehen, to cut the losses, wie man auf Englisch sagt, denn sie mussten sich auch selber darum kümmern, was zu Hause bei ihnen lief, denn da ging ja auch mittlerweile alles drunter und drüber. Und so bekam Namibia dann seine Unabhängigkeit nach all diesen Jahren des Unabhängigkeitskampfes. Und 1990 kam dann auch die formelle Unabhängigkeit, wir hatten dann Unabhängigkeitswahlen für ein neues namibisches Parlament, gab es ja vorher noch nie und seit 1990 sind wir jetzt unabhängig als Namibia. Und es ist eben in diesem Befreiungskampf, wo es darum geht, gegen diesen Rassismus und diese Unterdrückung zu kämpfen, für die Unabhängigkeit, dass also auch Trudis Geschichte da eben reinpasst. Und ich hoffe, dass ich damit einen kurzen Overview gegeben habe. Also bitte.
Yeah. Yeah, vielen Dank. Thank you. We now switch back to English and let you give you the floor to introduce yourself and your book.
Thank you, Julia. I think I have already introduced myself. I will just briefly give you an overview of the book because you haven't read it. Just three paragraphs I'm going to give to you. This is really a book which started with when I was very young and up to the independence of Namibia. But before I did that, I wrote two chapters. It has altogether 9 chapters. The two first ones is about my background, my ancestors, where I come from, which is an explanation why I reacted in a certain way when I was thrown in at the deep end. So I'm setting this scene where I'm just a village girl coming from a rural area, really a very closed, as Wilfried was saying, that we were in segregation. You're supposed to stay here and not there. You can only go to school here and not there, within Namibia. So in the end, you grow up like this. You know your village, you know the Catholic mission where you went to school, and that's it. So by the time I step out of Namibia in 1977, I only know my village, the people who spoke exactly the same accent as me, and then the Catholic missions. That's it. Now, the second part of the book has a number of chapters about the 12 years I spent outside Namibia in exile. So here I describe my first contact with the Namibian liberation movement known as SWAPO, as my husband just said. The time I discovered the camps in the neighboring countries, Angola and Zambia. I then discovered that there exists something called an aeroplane. When I was put on an aeroplane, Alitalia, to fly from Luanda to Zambia, then I had to learn how to live in town. What does it mean when the lights, the traffic lights, turn green? What does it mean when it is red? It sounds funny, but this, I was already 18 when I got to know this. This is really, and this is not only my story, it's the story of any Namibian who was born during my time or just before. So you can take my name out and replace it with somebody else's name, take out the countries where I have been, and you put other countries, and it becomes somebody else's story. It's really our common story. So then, this is way too long. So I think what I really want you maybe to understand, because is people would say, but it's so difficult to be away for 12 years. What is it that pushed you to leave the country? Wilfried has explained a bit, but we sneaking out of Namibia was just something we all were doing. And going into exile, and this started really in 1960, where some people left earlier, but there were not that many. The real exodus of young people started in 74, when on an annual basis, there were tens of thousands of Namibians just streaming out of the country. But you must also remember that we were living illegally. There were no Namibian passports. So we walk across the border and then you walk. But one thing we knew was that once you have left, you can never come back. And we understood that to come back can only happen when Namibia gains independence. And that's why there was this determination really to put our efforts in liberating our country, because that was the only way we could go back. Otherwise, we will just remain in exile. And then the third part deals with my life just before Namibia's independence. Going back home, where I've not been for 12 years, and settling back in an independent Namibia. It is during this period that I got my first job, so I described that. That's when I bumped into a white comrade, because before there were only black comrades, so that's when I met Wilfried. This is the time also we both knew that when we go to Namibia, we'll face problems with our respective families. I couldn't just turn up in the village with and say, this is my future husband. It wouldn't work. And Wilfried couldn't dare to take me to Swakopmund, where he's from, and say, this is Trudy and I will marry her. So we had to find very convincing ways to convince our families why we think it is right that the two of us could get married, because it was not happening before. Why do we think we are clever? So that was, but believe me, we in the long run managed. And we managed quite well. Let me also say that in the book you'll also see that it's not easy always to have a plain sailing life. There are always challenges in life. And that also happened to me despite the fact that the exile life was already challenging. I had personal problems which I described in the book, or challenges. The first one is the death of my mother in a car accident 2 years after I had just left home. Leaving my many siblings, we are 9 children, I'm the first one, my youngest brother was 2. But I again picked myself up and say, I need to move forward, and once I succeed, one day I look after my siblings. And I managed that too. Then it was also during this period of time that as a young person, I got myself into a very short marriage. Got married in Yugoslavia, at all places, Yugoslavia. And this wedding or marriage left me very shattered, pregnant 1 month, but then I had to go to move on. And the birth of my daughter really gave me that inspiration to move on. So I'm just giving these two examples to say, whatever happens, one must just, you know, pick oneself up and continue. Lastly, maybe a word about the title of the book. Why Taming My Elephant? I'm explaining in the book that in the culture where I am from, long time ago, people lived closer to animals, wildlife animals. And elephants were considered as the most threatening animal to human beings. So village people would make plans and say, tomorrow we'll do A, B, C, D. And before they part, they would say, yes, let's do that, provided that the night does not give birth to an elephant. Meaning, if we wake up tomorrow and they say, elephant meets us here, we put the plan aside and we fight the elephant and get rid of the elephant. It's just a saying, I see her big eyes. No, that's how we looked at it and say, if you have really a big problem like having an elephant meet you, you better deal with that elephant first before you do something else. Roughly, this is the overview about my book, and I really leave it there. Otherwise, I take up too much time.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, and you mentioned a lot of interesting points, and some points we will also intensify as we speak. For example, you already mentioned that this fate of yours was shared by so many, so exile was a collective experience. But then again, from my point of view, when I look at your history, it's quite remarkable. I mean, you've left the country at the early age of 17, You joined the liberation struggle, went to exile. You lived in Angola, Zambia, Tanzania, Kenya, Senegal, and France with occasional visits to Yugoslavia. And so, yeah, as you mentioned as well, it was only 12 years later that you came back home. So, and then your autobiography was published 2016, so it's a very contemporary piece, so it's a very recent publication. Why did you decide to write it down? Why did you decide at the age of, you must have been 56, 7 then? 57, I think? Is it okay if I reveal it?
Oopsie. Of course. Okay. Don't worry about that. Yeah. I'll be 16 2 days' time, so you can already wish me happy birthday.
Yeah, why did you decide to write your book?
No, I started writing this book way long time ago. I think I started 25 years ago. I put a few things down, and then I changed my mind. I left it, and I came back to it. But the first reason why I wrote the book, it was for my children. I have four daughters, and these four daughters just know me in our house in Windhoek. And we live in a nice suburb of Windhoek called Ludwigsdorf. So for my children, they think I've always been in Ludwigsdorf. And I've only known the life we know together. They cannot imagine me going to school on foot without shoes, because every time they say, "Mommy, drop us at school." They cannot imagine that I saw light the way we know it when I was 13. They cannot imagine that I only got to know how to turn the tap, or you know, to say, you know, you just turn a water tap on and you get water. No, I never knew that. And I never spoke on the phone until I was 22. So I thought my children really don't know me. They know me only by the time, you know, they got to know me as their mother. Then there was also my husband's family who would sit around the table and talk about very complicated things which are typical German culture. Then there was this Pünktlichkeit. Every time, lunch is 12:30. You can't come 12:32. That's not allowed. Then we must go to the beach. I must sit in the sun. Why do I need to sit in the sun? And all these things. So I really felt, and people expected me to react in a normal way that, yes, this is normal for me. You know, my children will say, "Mommy, what do you give us for Christmas?" The Christmas tree, and then the tooth fairy. No, I didn't know all this. So I wanted just to show that part of my background and a different experience. That was really the initial reason why I wanted to write the book. But first, I really wanted to make it just as a family story. Nothing more. But as I sat down and recalled a number of things, I really thought, especially what I went through during 12 years in exile, was amazing. I know the time it was happening, I thought, this is nothing. When somebody say, "Tomorrow you're going to Lusaka, we take you to the airport," you have never been in an airport, and then put in the plane. And then 2 years later, you're going to study in France. And I thought, in French? France and French? French is a language which is very far from Namibians. And it just went on, and I finished studying, and then I went back to Lusaka, to Angola. Next thing, you go and teach at the UN Institute for Namibia. In the end, for me, I'm saying, whatever happened to me, I never planned it. I didn't apply anything. Things just happened. And as Namibians say, you just need to be in the right place at the right time. And this is really my whole life story, and I just find it very amazing. And that's why I put it down.
Thank you. Yeah, let's go back to that point, to that moment when it all started, when you left to exile. Can you explain a bit, or maybe even read a passage from your book, how your exodus, your personal one, your path to exile started?
Okay. We said earlier that going into exile was really nothing unusual for us Namibians. Every day you would hear those years, so-and-so has left. And you only get to know when people have left. For security reasons, they never said so. In our case, we did not go on our own. We later were told that we were assisted to go into exile. But it doesn't matter for me today. In a normal circumstances, from a distance, you'll say you were kidnapped as school children. Probably. But in the end, for us, this was the best what could happen to us. Because after secondary school, what could we have done? There was no single university in Namibia. Our parents had no money to send us to South Africa, as his parents did. So I had two opportunities as a black girl. Either I become a teacher or a nurse. Now, we went through an amazing story, which somehow at the beginning looked like, when I think about, I was even speaking about it this afternoon because I visited my two teachers who were at the same school. They're Germans. They stay in Aachen.
Aachen.
So we were there this afternoon. They've been living there since 78 because once we left for exile in 77, there was no more jobs for them, so they had to come back to Germany. But we really laugh about it today. So what happened is, all of a sudden, one day, a whole army just appeared in our midst. But really, hundreds of armed soldiers. And they say, wake up, let's go. We first reacted, where are we going? No, we're just going to tell you something. So we followed, we had to go. And 2 days later, we were in Angola, we walked. Not even 2 days, the following day. And then we were in the camps, and they explained to us that they needed more learners, more school kids to go for studies. They had just too much offer from the outside world to train Namibians, but they didn't have enough people with good education. We were from a Catholic school. And we were children who did not understand. In normal circumstances, they could have just talked to us nicely and convinced us, blah, blah. But there was no time. So, and they didn't, and 2 kilometers away, there was a huge South African army base. The danger would have, if South Africa would have suspected, it would have been a big problem. I think, for me, it was an amazing undertaking how they walked in that mission station, and I think we were more than 100, and they just took us. Nothing happened. No South African turned up. Some of our teachers were caught at the border and were brought back. So it's a scary story, I know, but those of us who managed to go back home, when we sit down and talk about it, we laugh about it, but we are also happy that it happened this way, because most of us did university studies. Most of us went to the UN Institute for Namibia in Lusaka for 3 years. I went to France. A good number of my friends went to Germany. They studied in Leipzig. Some went to the UK, to the United States, and we could all go back to Namibia to contribute to the development of our country. And when you compare it to the other people, when we arrived in Lusaka, in Zambia, there were some students from Windhoek, because they had information, they could come out on their own. There were those from Martin Luther High School, closer to Marienthal. So there was just so many students coming out that those of my colleagues who managed, because some people could run away, they 3 months later, when they understood, they followed us. So it's, I really put it in the book that way to show also the other side of the liberation movement of Namibia, SWAPO, which we were told these are not human beings. And we were really scared because we thought if they are not human beings, they're certainly going to eat us up. Today we are still sitting here, they didn't eat us. So it's a story which I just thought, I went through this and I wanted it to be in the book. You can ask me questions later.
Yeah, but still maybe you could expand a bit on life in exile. How did it look like? Because first you came into camps, into settlements. There were different kinds of settlements. And you already mentioned there was always a lot of movement also for yourself. But how did life in exile look like?
I hope my husband can also help me because he has also seen it. Initially, we had, you have two type of camps. You have the camps where you receive those who come from home, new people, and process them through to go for either for military training or for education. Younger children will go to the education and health settlements. They were also different, health centers. Young people who were between 14 and 17, they were sent to secondary schools in African countries because there was no way they could be sent to universities, especially in Europe, without abitur for you. So they needed that piece of paper to be admitted here. So that's why for those who went to Germany, they had to do abitur. So Germany could do that, but certain countries were only offering us university studies. So they had to go to Ghana, Nigeria, the Gambia, wherever we could find space for them to go for secondary school and get a grade 12. Then most of us were sent to Europe. I know the first person who came to Europe was in Poland, Dr. Libertine, who became the first medical doctor in our camps. Some went to Finland, some went to the United States, and so on. So those were the type of camps, but we had also military camps, as I say, because we were waging a war. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I can refer to a picture here or two, the maps that you included in your book, as well to really visualize your personal journey there. So maybe you could quickly summarize again like how your journey proceeded. So you first went to Angola by foot, then you went to Zambia, right?
And then, okay, yes, then elsewhere. Mm-hmm. If I can see better. Okay, I'm from northern Namibia. So there, down there, we started off, we went into Angola. In Angola, I've been in two camps. There are the camps which are at the borders, but those you cannot keep young people for a long time, because South Africa could attack those camps because they were military camps. So we stayed only 2 weeks in the first camp. Then we moved to the next one, which was 200 kilometers away from Namibia. There we stayed 3 months. And from there, we flew to Zambia. And I studied in Zambia for 3 years. And from on there, then we had a 1 year of traveling. Because as we were studying or fighting for Namibia, we were also preparing our policies for independence Namibia without knowing when, but we wanted to have the policies in place. So I was sent with a group of other students, we were 9 altogether, to look at the experience. experience of other African countries in relation to housing policy. What was their situation right at independence? What did they do to provide more housing? Where did they succeed? Where did they fail? And what did they do to address those? Because you get always many people coming to urban areas immediately after independence. So we wanted just to see what did Tanzania do. And then from Tanzania, we spent a month in Tanzania, we spent 2 months in Tanzania, and then we said, okay, let's also see what a Francophone African country did, because they had a French background. And then from there, we went to Mozambique. I see Mozambique is not on it, but we stayed very short in Mozambique. So this was my first part up to between 1977 to 1980. In 1981, that's when I went to France for university studies, and I stayed in France up to 86 October, and then I finished studying, and then I went back to Africa. That was my route.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that summary. You then in your book also talk extensively about your experience in Europe, because then you were really very far from Namibia, from your home country. Would you like to read some parts on your experience there, maybe?
Now, I don't know where to find that.
Just a picture. Yeah, afterwards.
Mm-hmm. The one in Vichy, or...?
Yeah, for example, as you wish. We could also just talk further.
Okay, now, my stay in France, we first came for six weeks, just to learn French. Mm-hmm. But we came in December, and we didn't know the European winter. I'm trying to see who was dressed a bit. Maybe you, but your dress is thicker. So we were in cotton dresses. And we arrived, and I think the French suspected that we were going, since we were going to be funded by the French government through the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they sent someone to meet us at the airport. So we saw somebody with something saying Namibia, so we went to that person. Of course, we're not really speaking French, so the first thing that poor lady did with the nine of us is to take us to a market. We had to, each of us must take trousers, a jersey, a coat, and boots. And then we could then go to the ministry to complete forms and blah, blah. And then we went to a town called Vichy, where we stayed for 6 weeks, going to French classes 5 hours a day. So we went through a very tough time, and then it started snowing, and we didn't understand what was happening. And then the time we wanted to go back, then the French railway, SNCF, was on strike. So there was one flight per week, and we insisted we wanted to go back, so they took us to Paris by bus so that we could go to Zambia at that time. Then I came back again a year later when I came for a longer period. We were just three girls, and we thought, okay, let's try it. So we started with French again, and because we needed them to go to the university for 4 years, so we needed really to know good French. So it was, of course, very difficult, and but we also told ourselves there are those who are now also learning in Russian or in Finnish. Are we really worse off? So we put in all our efforts, and there are a few, I think one or two decided, no, this is too difficult, I'm going back. But I persisted, and there were other foreigners as well. We were not the only foreigners, and we managed. And today I teach even French.
Yeah. Yeah, and you in the very introduction you also mentioned that there in while you were in France you then had your first short marriage, which then ended very very difficult for you and was quite an obstacle. But then as you returned after you finished your studies, you started a new relationship and you met somebody new. Maybe we could talk about that. And maybe that's the time where we could have a look into the book and also look at the picture.
Okay, maybe this I can bring to you.
Don't be surprised, I put up a picture here. Sorry. Where did you get that? From your book.
It's in the book. Book.
It's also in the book. Okay, now I'm going to read this passage to you. One fine morning in February 1988, I, for some reason, I was now teaching at the institute where I started 10 years earlier. One fine morning in February 1988, I, for some reason, decided to step out of my office for a while. As I turned into the long corridor leading toward the main entrance of the institute, I bumped into the director, Comrade Hage Kainkop. He was in the company of a young, bearded white man. As I apologetically tried to pass them without disturbing their conversation, I uncomfortably noticed their slowing down. As I smiled uneasily, I barely heard the director introduce the visitor to me. This is Comrade, and then he stopped there. I got stuck at the word comrade. I did not get the visitor's surname, nor did I hear the director introducing me to him. None of that mattered, because my mind was brought to a halt. Did I really hear the word comrade? The director of all people referring to the fellow as comrade? Why did he do that? Comrade was a sacred word for us. Although this was not an official position, we at the back of our minds knew that whites in Namibia were the reason of our struggle. Yes, it was a system, but the system was run by whites, and at the same time, this system gave privileges to whites only, and hence our plight. And here I was in front of one of my respected national leaders introducing me to a white comrade. Those days when we spoke to each other and referred to each other as comrades, we meant Namibians. Could this be the case? If things were all right for this white person back home, what was he doing here? So this is the passage. My first impression I heard when I met the white comrade.
So what was he doing? What was he doing in exile? Would you like
what
to
was I doing in exile? Well, I already mentioned earlier on that I had gone into exile because I was absolutely refusing to be conscripted into the South African military force. Having this idea that you occupy your own country, delay your own country's independence. Those were things that were, for me, wrong. And I was an activist at the time. I was, a student at university. You learn new things and so on. And I had become, already inside Namibia, I'd become a SWAPO member. And when it came then, every year one gets a letter from the military saying you have to report by that and that day. And you go back to the university, get the stamps and so on. No, still studying there. And then all of a sudden at the end of 1985, when I'd sent in all the letters that I would again study there in 1986, and then the letter came back and said, no, your application for deferment has been turned down. And then I realized, oops, my time is running out. And I had to decide what to do. And I, of course, consulted our leadership, said, what do I do? Do I become a martyr. Do I let them put me into jail and we make a big publicity thing out of that? Look here, people get locked up because they're refusing to fight. But the answer I got was, no, we already have enough people in jail. Don't do that. Get yourself into exile. And that's what I did. Maybe not quite as romantic. No, romantic is the wrong word to say what that forced march that Trudy and them were doing during the night to cross the border into Angola. My way was much simpler. I got on the plane to Frankfurt. It arrived also some cold winter morning at Frankfurt Airport and found my way to England. I still studied another year in England. And then when I was there, said, okay, now what do I do? The SWAPO leadership was somehow under of the impression, because mind you, there were a few other, I was not the only young white person who had left the country. There were a couple of others hanging around here in Germany and other countries in Europe. And I said, no, I don't want to be another one of those. I want to do something where I can contribute. And then in the end, there came the idea, well, I could also teach at this UN Institute for Namibia. And I arrived there in early in February. That the month was mentioned, 1988. And I arrived there. And right in the first week, I was introduced to the director of this UN Institute for Namibia, Hage Geingob. He's the current president of Namibia. And we talked a bit, and then he said, come on, I'll introduce you to all the colleagues. And we went down the corridors from office to office, and he said, okay, here's a new staff member, can I introduce? And then we came to Trudy's office, and yeah, she just read you that story.
Yeah, and you described not only in the passage, but throughout the following pages of your book, how skeptical you were towards him. And you continue to meet each other, and yeah, we see this picture of one of those occasions. But that's a very dominant topic, that you did not really trust him, or you were very reluctant to be to become closer with him, so to say. Where was that the case?
That's a very complicated topic for people who do not really know apartheid. When you know apartheid and you have lived it, it was very difficult. I don't know how Wilfried moved so faster than me, but it was a rule in Namibia. There was a law. I don't know when it was scrapped. But there was a law saying whites and blacks are not supposed to marry. That we all knew. That's number one. Number two, in Namibia, you see the white people at a far distance. You don't need to come closer to them. What are you doing there? They live separately in their little places. We live over there. They go to different schools. When do you meet them? When do you get to know them? We only got to know from those men who went to work in town, because they went to work for white people. So there was really this huge division that to make us to come closer, you needed some time. As I say in the book, I would have maybe reacted differently if Wilfried was, for example, American, or like we say, a German, because there are different Germans, Namibia, Namibian Germans. So it is really nobody's fault that things worked out that way. And even among the white Namibians, there this separation is still, it was there. If you are Afrikaans speaking or you are German speaking, there were very few English speakers. They all went their separate ways. In the area where Wilfried lives in Swakopmund, up to today, everybody around there speaks German. And I'm the only one who, when I'm there, look different. And it's really a big undertaking. And bit by bit, I realized, it took, of course, a bit of time, you know, okay, maybe he's genuine. But I think roughly it took us 6 months, but that's not too long.
Yeah, thank you. I'm jumping a bit here because the problems you describe about your personal, so to say, developing a new mindset about a white person such as Wilfried, the same happened to you when you both returned. So we learned already your path obviously crossed, and then once voices grew louder that independence would come, you both left to Namibia again. That was 1989. And with you, just to give some background information, at the time of the people returning to go to vote in Namibia, the count of the people returning was in total 11,813 women and 16,988 men who returned. Is that not?
How much is that together? I only know the total figure. I've never looked at the breakdown.
How much is that?
I think they were counted as 41,000 roughly.
Okay, so that's an incredible number. And the two of you then went back home together, and then you already hinted at that fact, you had to also disclose your new partners to your respective families, and that was a difficult path, as you describe in your book. Could you tell us a bit about that as well? Or you, if you wish. As you please, you can also just explain it. You can also do that.
Yeah, maybe a little bit start.
Oh, okay, that's not covered in the book, by the way. She only just refers to it, but yeah, Wilfried somehow found a way. Obviously I was come in 1988 to Lusaka, Zambia. I met Trudy, we fell in love, we started a relationship, and the world was perfect. I never wrote home to say, oh, by the way, I've got a girlfriend now, and she happens to be black. No, kept quiet. I wrote letters home, but that topic was never even touched upon. And then came 1989, and all of a sudden, okay, there's agreement at the UN, and Namibia is now to start a process towards independence, and we are all supposed to now go back to Namibia and register for elections and so on. And that is there when we realized, oh, now I have to start facing reality. You know, you come back home, and all of a sudden there is this type of thing. So I already had, just to send word home, some elder brothers of mine happened to be visiting my parents, and I'd actually ask them and say, can you please tell the parents? So when I came, they had heard, yes, okay, Wilfried is coming home and he's got a black girlfriend. And my parents asked me next to nothing. It was sort of a topic they also just ignored. And they were sort of, I think, hoping that he's in one of these phases and that will go away. Maybe there in Zambia there were no white girls, so he only landed up with a black girl. Now that he comes back to Namibia, maybe things will come right again. But obviously they didn't get right. But I think the biggest issue that I had was then when a few months later our first baby together was on the way. And now I had to really start thinking, okay, now how do I tell my parents that? And that definitely was not easy. Not that my parents are the worst racists that you may find in Namibia. If you look for different shades of racism, you can get a lot worse than what my parents have ever been. But nevertheless, the idea of, you know, black and white and having children together, that was also somewhere beyond what, you know, they could possibly cope with. And I had to find a way to tell them. And I must say, I was also very, not very courageous in saying so. In the end, the last day came that I traveled back to Lusaka and actually having taught my parents. And again, I had to make use of my brothers and say, I'm leaving you with something. Can you convey that message to them? So it was them who told my parents, and then my mother would, every week there was a letter coming through the post war damals noch, bevor wir auf Computer schrieben und ja, also das sich mal ausdrucken konnten oder so. Das war halt getippt mit Durchschlag.
Aber war sie in Namibia damals oder in Lusaka mit Ihnen?
Mit wir waren.
Als diese Nachricht kam durch ihre Brüder.
Ja, wir waren schon wieder zurück in Lusaka. We had a job to finish. We after the elections had to go back to Lusaka because the work of the UN Institute for Namibia had to continue. We only came back for good at the end of 1990, a year later. Now here the letter in mit Durchschlag. Ich bin einer von fünf, also original. Wenn du den letzten Durchschlag abbekommst, dann kannst du schon fast nichts mehr lesen. Die kam immer einmal in der Woche kam die Post und plötzlich war da Sendepause. For a good number of weeks there was no more letter coming, and that was the time when my parents really had to now chew through this issue, get over it, come to understand it. Luckily, one of my elder brothers, he was still there spending some time, and he pushed my parents, like, what is the real problem? And then in the end, the only real problem was, what do the neighbors think? Say, if that's your only problem, forget about the neighbors. Ignore them. They have got their own issues, and just forget about it. And so gradually, my parents got through the whole thing, and then the yellow letters started again. So when then a few months later, that time our daughter was then born, and we came on a visit to Namibia for just a few weeks. Then, of course, yes, now they want to see Trudy. Yes, they also want to see the baby. And then from there, bit by bit, the relationship improved.
But how was that all for you? I remember one quote in a conversation we had earlier which really struck me, and you said, in very plain words, I was not surprised. I expected way worse than that.
Yeah. As I said earlier, we are both born and bred in Namibia. So we know our communities. We know the mentalities. And take it this way. My parents-in-law were already, my mother-in-law turned 60 that year. And she lived in Namibia already for 40 years. And she, because she was born in Germany, it's my father-in-law who is, you know, Namibian, so to speak. So she really knew only the small communities she lived in. And the black people she knew were the lady who was cleaning her house or the gardener. Those were the people she knew. And now all of a sudden, you have your son bringing a black person in your house to sit at the same table, use the same toilet. I'm putting it to you that way. And this has not happened to any of her friends, any of her relatives or whoever. Why me? I did not expect anything different. I even thought I will never know his parents. But as soon as they started coming closer, and you know, gradually we started talking and getting to know each other, all of a sudden I just became a normal daughter-in-law. So I know it sounds a bit, you think it's too easy, but even today, you will count Namibians who, from different races, marry. If it is a Namibian with a foreigner that you see, but Namibians together, it's a challenge. It's the mentality, it's how your parents grew up, and you know, there are just certain things you don't do. So it's coming, apparently, but it's difficult.
Slow and coming.
Yeah.
So let me refer again to a picture you added in your book, as you might recall, of your marriage. And I'd like to read a small passage from your book about your marriage, where you described it. Maybe you can refer to that. So you said, by the time we married, there were no more than five other six mixed couples in Windhoek. Five other mixed couples in Windhoek, if not the entire country. It was a novelty, and we attracted attention as we moved around. It became worse when carrying a baby around. With a baby, there was no way we could pass for colleagues or unusual friends. And this turning of heads was not only from one section of society, but from across the board. I'm not sure whether my observation was correct, but what I saw in the eyes of those who turned their heads to stare at us can be divided into two classic expressions. The glare of the whites portrayed complete perplexity at the fellow white being completely out of his mind. As for my people, they clearly portrayed a sense of betrayal by a fellow black marrying an enemy. In any case, pioneers of any adventure always have to endure the clearing of the way. So was that then your next challenge, the next elephant that you had to tame, being a pioneer and clearing the way at that point?
I think so. Yeah, it was not an easy time, but we knew, we expected it to happen that way. And I think, well, the only thing we could do, he was the one, because either we leave the baby at home and we went to town to pretend we're just colleagues. But if you need to take the baby to the doctor, you need to take the baby with you. So this was really our situation that time. And
but we never would leave the child home just to,
no, because
we want to pretend something. We didn't.
Because he would always say to me, ignore them. So he was brave. So he would just do as if he didn't see anything. I couldn't do that. Because seriously, the black people also thought, how can you marry a white person after what the whites did to us? So the problem was really that we didn't at that time take human beings as individuals. You just lump them together. You are this, therefore you are this. It's a mentality which is still in our society, unfortunately, because to change people's mentality, it takes generations.
And here's one last picture, and then we can also open the discussion. Here you show us that obviously progress in your cases, in your case, was possible. And you're really a big family now. You also included a picture of the smaller family here. So it got more and more difficult, I assume, to hide the baby at home once they were four. So I think these are excellent personal insights, and I thank you very much for sharing it in your book, but also here with us. And I'm sure there are a lot of questions now, and I'd like to open for a discussion. If people are interested. Are there any questions? Yes, please.
So first of all, thank you very much for being here and telling us all stories of your life. I have a question to all the traveling you did to France and studying there, and then to Angola and Senegal and so on. So did the SWAPO help organize that, or how was all of that possible?
Yeah, that's a very relevant question. SWAPO had a lot of international support because of the background of Namibia's history, that the UN felt so much responsible about what happened, and you have so many Namibians outside the country. So the UN had a structure for Namibians. So there was the UN Council for Namibia, like a government for Namibians of the UN outside the country. Then they created the UN Institute for Namibia to train future Namibian civil servants. That was the intention. And then they had a fund to pay for Namibian studies, but that they did initially for those who left the country in the 60s. Like, if you go to Namibia today, the current president, the speaker, these are the people who studied in the United States and the UN and in Canada and the UK. So they were all paid for by the UN for Namibia Fund. Then as more governments got to understand the plight of Namibians, all African schools or secondary schools opened up for us. And they took as many Namibian young people to go to secondary schools. And SWAPO paid 0 cents. It was a solidarity thing. Then we got scholarships. It can be from NGOs. It can be from governments. So France, for example, in our case, started giving SWAPO scholarships through the UN Institute for Namibia in Lusaka. We started three, but the agreement was if the three of us would succeed, every year the French government will give SWAPO 10 scholarships. And this is how the Namibian population or student population grew. And then you had certain countries which would say, we'll just give you a whole school. We built a whole school in our country for you. Cuba did that for us. Another African country called Congo Brazzaville, we had a secondary school just paid for by the government there. So this was really a solidarity thing. And that's why it was difficult for us as Namibians to say, I want to go to China and not to Cuba. Mm-hmm. We were thousands. If the scholarship come, 30, like we are all waiting to go to studies, so we have 10, I just say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, go and pack tomorrow, you're going to Cuba. Mm-hmm. And we just did that. This is how it happened. So it was really an international solidarity. And you may even ask me, what did you eat in the camps? Food just came from all over the clothes. And it we became so... when we went back to Namibia, we left when we were youngsters. We went back when we were 30 years. You have never budgeted. You have never made a shopping list. So then we came back. Now we must look after ourselves. But for 12 years, we must just say, oh, my rice is finished, my sugar, I need more salt. And you go to a certain place, this is what I need. You get your ratio, you leave. Or somebody just cook big for everybody. You come with a plate. And all of a sudden, you must have your own house. When we started buying a house, I didn't even know what to do. Yeah. So it was really an international solidarity story. Yeah.
We have another question there.
In the context of, because you're talking of the years before 89, so we're talking about the years of the Cold War, and you're saying that Western and Eastern countries, or Eastern but not Western countries, were supporting the SWAPO. How was that happening in this time where these parts of the world were fighting so strongly? How would they cooperate the same movement, but actually be enemies?
Maybe I can try to answer that. I mean, with something like apartheid, even a Western country couldn't pretend like it wasn't happening. And however, of course, Western countries concentrated on humanitarian aid, pay for education, pay for some material supports that people can live in refugee camps, tents and blankets and whatever, that type of support that would easily come from Western countries, especially from, if it was the case, or from governments. But also there were lots of NGOs in Western countries that were mobilizing and collecting money to give support that the governments maybe would not give through the churches and through other organizations. There were all kinds of support things happening. if you then think, of course, of the former Soviet bloc, their, of course, support was anything from sending Kalashnikovs and whatever else, you know, apart from humanitarian aid. So support was coming from all sides because nobody wanted to be seen on the wrong side. Officially, the governments of Western Europe and North America, they did not want to be seen in bed with the South African apartheid government. But secretly, there were all kinds of things happening. There's even issues that they were giving the apartheid government support in developing nuclear bombs. Things like that were happening. But that was very secretive. But officially, there was always the thing that even governments like here in at that time in Germany, they would give support to SWAPO, but humanitarian only. You know, they wouldn't come anywhere close to anything that was maybe related to the armed struggle.
But maybe something we need also to mention is that we had a lot of SWAPO offices across the world. The first one was at the UN, to engage the UN. We had, for Western Europe, our biggest office was in London. So whoever wanted to support us would take, especially money, to London. Then we had an office in Bonn. We had an office from 1981 in Paris. Then, of course, Stockholm, Helsinki, then Belgrade at one point. So these people really went out to mobilize and talk to governments and make the situation clear why it was necessary for people to show their solidarity to Namibians, but also to support them militarily. We needed just to fight a war. So it was a unique situation. But when you look at it also, many people say today, Namibia is the most successful story of the UN system. The way the UN system dealt with the Namibian situation, yes, there was a war going on. For us, it was important because South Africa would not accept to come to the negotiation table if they don't feel the punch. So the international community also then spoke to South Africa, and maybe you have heard about the five Western countries, the contact group, who really from 1978 negotiated between SWAPO and South Africa. These were the United States, the UK, West Germany that time, Canada, and France. They really pushed. And finally, the plan which was accepted in 1978 could only be implemented in 1989. So 1978, we were very close, we were hopeful, and I really thought, wow, next year we go home. It took another 10 years. Negotiations, that's how it goes, but as soon as that was resolved, and South Africa and SWAPO has signed a ceasefire, we had really, I've seen the UN, what we call that time, UNTA, the UN group of people, thousands of soldiers coming from various countries of the world, the administration to run the Namibian system between April 1989, and they left only after March 1990, but some of them stayed on just to see how the new government take off. So now I have told you a too long story.
Now there's another question in the back, please.
Thank you very much for sharing your insights. I have a question concerning your daughters, because I assume there were not many mixed children. And my question is, how did they manage, and how did you as parents manage to maybe a different kind of racism, because they did not belong to either white or black?
In the Namibian context, it was not too difficult. because in Namibia, we always divide people in three groups: whites, coloreds, and blacks. We have a big colored community which just exists on its own. And when we went to school, you had schools for whites, schools for coloreds, and schools for blacks. So when we, and the way where also you stay, so when we are in Namibia, and you tell me I come from Klein Windhoek, that's a white suburb. If you say I come from Kommersdal, you are colored. If you come from Katutura, you are black. So now the schools also worked a bit like that. So by the time we went back to Namibia, somehow officially apartheid was no longer there. But if your child is already going to this school, you're not going to take your child out of that school to prove a point. So you keep the child there. So we put our children in a Catholic school, the convent, where there were all races were there. And the majority of children were coloreds. And our children did not really, I don't know, they didn't notice anything. They just saw us as their parents. And they were convinced that one day, because they are girls, because my first daughter is, she's from my first marriage, but she's lighter of complexion, lighter than me. So my other three, especially number two, thought, as you grow older, you will get darker and darker. By the time you are mommy's age, you're just black. So this is just the process. So they never really, we didn't need to pay any special attention. You just needed them to have confidence and really, you know, feel, no, that is, for them it never happened.
Which does not mean that they did not face all kinds of issues of racism. That would be too simplistic to say it isn't. But I think they should rather even talk for themselves about their experiences growing up in Namibia and what acceptance or non-acceptance they've been facing from the different communities. Especially from the white community, I'm very much aware about instances of racism that they have been facing. And then it's a matter of counseling them, helping them to understand the situation and also to tell them, like I always say, ignore them. If they are not too nice to you, then just do not associate with them. That's also how I do it. I do not try to go to a part of Windhoek into a bar where I know all the racists are hanging out. I wouldn't want to be there. I don't go there. Finish full stop. Mm. And that's the way to do it, in my opinion.
Maybe to put this in a context, you might update me here if I'm mistaken, but from the numbers I've been reading or the books we have here, is that currently 5% of the population are white, as I've read, and 1% would be of German descent, so that's about 20,000. Is that still correct?
Yes, the number of German-speaking people in Namibia is about 20,000. It's actually a very, very small number. Mm. You can go to Paris, you'll find more German speakers in Paris than in the whole of Namibia. And yet you don't take note of them there. Even in South Africa, there are some big cities, Johannesburg, Cape Town, for instance. Each one of them has got more German speakers than the whole of Namibia. And yet, nobody even takes note of them. But in Namibia, somehow, the German speakers stand out. They're also, of course, dominant in certain sectors of the economy, like farming and also in commerce and so on. And somehow we are, in a way, standing out more. And the German culture is still being held up. The only German language daily newspaper, Tageszeitung, nicht Wochenzeitung, that exists anywhere in the world outside of the German language area here in Europe, That is in Namibia.
Allgemeine Zeitung.
That one. So there is something there, but there is also, you know, up to this day, there's certain support from government, because the Germans are forming, at least in terms of numbers, they're about 1% of the total population. There is therefore, by government, provision that German can also be taught at schools. And for that matter, for these young German-speaking children, they will learn in grade one reading and writing in German. They don't have to learn that in English. English is only brought in subsequently. And there is even a German language radio station run by the government broadcasting corporation. You would not expect to find that anywhere else, but it is there, and that's why German influence is still very much felt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can I be just a quick question to that? Did you raise your daughters bilingually? Did you talk to them in German also?
No, here we have a situation that it would become trilingual in the end, because Trudy's language is not English either. And since we communicate in English with each other, because I'm not good enough in her language as that I can say terribly much, except for some greetings and some things. It has therefore never been a common language. The common language has always been English, so they grew up English. And I also, in the end, think it was maybe better that way. They know a little bit of German, but I think they learned more from my mother, that's not their grandmother, than what they learned from me.
Further questions, yes,
please. I have a question for you. You lived in an era where, in your youth, you dedicated a big part of your life for the independence of Namibia so that your children and the generations after you would be able to live where they want to study where they want to become whomever they choose without having the cap of society tell them who they are and where they belong. And it's wonderful to be able to say, in a way, that whole generation of people lived to see it. There are many who didn't. But I'd like to hear from you, what do you dream for Namibia for the future? We've seen an era come and go, and now we've still got a long road ahead of us. Well, and what do you hope for the future for Namibia, for you? Maybe for your grandchildren who are yet to come, or well, maybe they already.
That's a very difficult question. I think we as a government has really a dream. And that dream, where are you from?
I'm raised in Bintu, but my family is from Shakati.
So you're Namibian?
I am.
Oh, okay. I'm sure you know the government vision, what the government is trying to achieve. We have the vision 2030, the famous plan, to make Namibia an industrial, a prosperous country by the year 2030. It's no more far away, but the cornerstone for all these things is what we have been saying, peace and stability. That we need. We have seen what is happening in the other countries. I'm currently in Senegal. Senegal is a stable country, but is surrounded by many unstable countries. And as long as you don't have peace, as long as you don't have stability, development can never happen. And I think we as Namibians, after 28 years is not long, to create a nation, because that was our first goal, just to unify Namibians and to say, today we are Namibians. Because before I would rather say I'm first of Ambo before I become anything else. I'm Herero, I'm this. But today we are all Namibians. Even if my husband was talking about the German language radio, German is one of the national languages or Afrikaans. So we really try to say, let's hold hands and let's move on. After that, we need now to grow our economy and diversify it. So, and I don't know if you have heard about the land conference which just took place in Namibia. It's a very difficult topic we are dealing with, but as long as we are not dealing with it properly, you know, that will always be a setback. But I think my dream is that we move away from all these differences, the physical differences we see, and just hold hands as Namibians and move forward. We are lucky that we are only 2.3 million. And I think for 2.3 million, you can do something. When I look at the Senegalese, they are 14 million. And in Dakar, that little place, is 3 million of people. Not even the entire population of Namibia. So, yes, we have a challenge of our education system, but I'm sure we are trying to work on it. And I somehow have hope that we can make it, and maybe 2030 is close now, but with our national development plans, I'm sure we can get closer to our vision of 2030. We must all just come back home and work.
Okay. Yeah, I think with that wonderful statement and that look into the future, we should finish our... Okay, we have one last question, and then...
Just because you just said we should all come back home, I wanted to ask, how was that for you to come actually back home after living in exile for 12 years? How are the people who live in exile were received? Because I know from other countries that it sometimes varies from people ran away or actually are celebrated when they come back. Like, how was that for you?
Yeah, I think coming home, our parents, our families wanted to see us back. When exactly, nobody could say. Those of us who were exiled were dreaming about nothing else but going home. So when this happened, and it really happened too fast for everybody, unexpectedly, so it was a big joy for us. Of course, when you have been away for 12 years, it is always a difficult thing to go back. You have been elsewhere. You have a different exposure than the rest of your family. They haven't known you for 12 years. My brother, the youngest, who was, you know, was not even born when I left. When I came, he was 12. So he looked at me from a distance. So we needed that time also to get to know each other and to know how to work together. But it didn't last really too long. People were very, you know, we very accommodative. Everybody was brought on board. One thing we decided is that every Namibian must be part. It doesn't matter from which group you are from. There are those who come from bigger groups. There are smaller ethnic groups. Everybody must be part of the government, in parliament, in whatever we do. You will be surprised if I tell you our finance minister, Kale Schlettwein, just the name. But that's our minister of finance. And then we have another one, USD, because you have these two group of white people in Namibia. So the Afrikaners must also be there, this one. And then as you do the whole, the ambassadors, everybody must be part of that big structure so that everybody feels, yes, the belongingness, the togetherness. That's the only way we can move forward. So I think we are fine.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much. Again, a nice final statement. And let me do some important final remarks. One is very important to me because Miss Amulungu volunteered to do this all without any payment. She came this long way, and really, I was so happy when you agreed to have this reading and discussion. So the least we could do is give around a small jar to gather donations, which will exclusively go to you, nobody else, not even the location. So we're going to do that now.
Oh.
Okay, which I'll find now.
Julia, no!
Yes, I'll just have to find it and then...
Oh. This is really a pleasure for me just to be here.
Okay, that's one thing. And then another thing I'd like to hand over to you is just a small present.
Wow.
One piece, yeah. Again, as a thank you for being
my
chocolate.
Thank you so much.
And a loaf of wine.